Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I am a feminist, and so is my friend Nat, but I offered her an obscene amount of beauty and skincare products if she could get this particular guest on our podcast today, because even though we are both strong, confident women, we are still easily swayed by the potions and pretties that can turn back the hands of time on our faces. Now, as you may have guessed from that little intro that I have totally stolen from the Guilty Feminist podcast, our guest today is the fabulous host of the super popular podcast, The Guilty Feminist, comedian Deborah Frances White.
Hello. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast. Now, I'm Liz Best here with Tom Harris.
Yes, hello.
Ghosts of Boyfriends Past. And today we're here to chat to Deborah Frances White, not just because she has a tour coming up in Australia and New Zealand, but also because she has a tour coming up in Australia and New Zealand. We're super excited. So first of all, tell us a little bit about when your tour is, Deborah Frances White, and what we can expect from it.
Yes, I love coming out to Australia and New Zealand, and I do it usually every year, but I haven't been out for 2 years, so I'm extra excited to come back. There's a big, excited audience of Guilty Feminists that come out, and I think the screaming and applause at the top, I always think, is mostly for making the flight. It's like, you came, thank you, 24 hours flying.
It's so far away.
Indeed. So we're in Christchurch on the 11th of May, Auckland on the 14th, and Wellington on the 15th. And I'm co-hosting those shows with Michelle Court. And then I'm in Adelaide on the 18th, Perth on the 20th, Sydney on the 23rd, Melbourne on the 25th, Brisbane on the 27th and 28th. I'm in Canberra. And I've got some incredible co-hosts, including Claire Hooper, Alice Fraser, Kirsty Wiebeck, Geraldine Hickey, and one other I'm not allowed to say yet. Oh. And Magda Sabansky is the guest in Melbourne, which is so exciting. But excitingly, we also have Eliza Hull and Roya the Destroyer. I don't know if you've seen their incredible song slash dance.
Yes,
it's absolutely amazing.
And
Alison J. Barton, who's an Indigenous poet. And in Sydney, very excitingly, we've got Bryony Dawson, who's the first ever non-binary host, presenter of a major Australian television show. Along with Tilly Lawless and Geraldine Hickey. And Brisbane, we've got Alice Fraser and Fadl Mawla, and also a guest yet to be announced. So if you could all come out for that, we're going to have a riotous time. It's going to be lots of song, dance. There's going to be a song, dance. What am I saying? There's going to be lots of stand-up comedy.
We've got a full choreographed number to open it with.
Sometimes. In Melbourne, we do actually. We've got Grace Petrie, who I'm bringing out from the UK. She's doing all the shows. She's in a brilliant, brilliant protest folk singer. She's very, very funny. Many of the listeners will know that, know her work. So there's song every night. There's stand-up comedy every night. There's deep dives with local feminist guests wherever we are. So you'll leave inspired, wired, ready to fight the patriarchy, but also full of joy, very entertained.
Wonderful.
That's
where can our dear readers find dates, find all this information?
Oh, I'm glad you've asked. Guiltyfeminist.com, and you just click on live shows, but the tickets are also available at the venues and Ticketek. But if your easiest one is just guiltyfeminist.com, click on live shows, and then you see the Australian New Zealand tour.
Fantastic.
Fabulous. Now, Deb, look, I doubt there are many people who have not heard of the Guilty Feminist podcast, but for our listeners, because they span many age groups and many diverse genders and everything like that, can you give us a little bit of a rundown on what the Guilty Feminist is and what you aim to do with it?
Yes, it's a funny show, as just described. We always do it live, unless there's some reason not to, like, I don't know, a pandemic.
Yeah.
Recently, we talked to Olivia Colman. She was filming in Australia, so that was a podcast via Zoom. So, but normally it's live in a theatre. So you can hear the kind of roar of the crowd. You can hear them laughing. You can hear them getting angry. You can hear them asking questions. So it feels like very community-based. I think that's why people come out, because they feel very activated, and, you know, their own community gets fired up. But it's really about our noble goals as 21st century feminists and our hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine those goals. So the beginning of it is always, you know, as you did brilliantly, Liz, the I'm a feminist but. So one of the first ones I ever did was, I'm a feminist, but I was looking for a new headshot photograph to use. And I said to my husband, what about this one? Do you think this looks a bit Dove campaign for real beauty? And he said, no, darling, you look lovely. And I thought, well, that campaign's failed.
Yes.
This looks a bit Dove campaign for real beauty. I don't want real beauty. I want actual billboard beauty.
Stunning.
Now, obviously, I know that that is not practical, but in the moment, and listen, I really do believe in real beauty for others. I can genuinely see what's beautiful about everybody, whether they've got a symmetrical face on some kind of weird patriarchal body standard that might get to be featured on a billboard for a L'Oreal commercial, or whether they're a 95-year-old woman with, you know, beautiful, you know, the wrinkles of time and experience and wisdom that actually do look genuinely beautiful for me. You know, on others, I can look at cellulite and see it's just like, it's really pretty. It's really, you know, it's alive. It's humanity. It's flesh. It's sexy. It's gorgeous. On myself, I believe in inner beauty for others. That's what I'm saying.
Look,
not for me.
When we were preparing for this interview, is that I turned on my camera because we're doing this over Zoom, obviously, and I was like trying to make myself look good on camera, even though we're not recording this video. No one's going to see this video. It's you guys who see me look like this every week. But I was still sitting there going, okay, how do I look pretty for I don't know who, but I just want to look like a pretty princess on camera. Damn it.
You look great. You look gorgeous, actually. I did think so. I did think, gosh.
And I'm a feminist, but I really enjoyed that compliment.
So beautiful.
Thank you.
It's so beautiful. So we do all sorts of confessions like that. And they're silly and they don't, you know, they're jokes. But interestingly, over the years, I think I've got, my feminism and my feelings about myself have become so much more powerful and feminist because I talk about it so much. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, I'll make that one line a joke, but then we kind of explore, why do we feel like that, you know, in a different sort of conversation. And I end up thinking, well, that's ridiculous. And so I actually can see more real beauty in myself, or I'm bolder about speaking up for a marginalized group that I might not otherwise have. I might have thought, oh, am I entitled to speak up like that? Or is this going to cause trouble? I'm so much bolder about my day-to-day feminism, A, how I feel about myself, and B, how I feel about my community, and, you know, how I feel about women and how women are treated, how I feel about, you know, different intersections of inequality. And I just do feel like it's really worked, because you can't talk about something the whole time and not retrain your brain. Your brain's so susceptible to what you say and what you do. And we've done so many campaigns over the years. And I do feel like a more powerful human being because you just practicing anything, it's like going to the gym. You can't just join the gym, go once, and expect it to alter your fitness, apparently.
So normally this podcast, when a guest comes on, we talk about stories from their dating past, but Deb doesn't really have much of a dating past because she pretty much just got married straight up, didn't you?
I did. Listeners, I was in a strange religious cult. I wasn't allowed to date. I wasn't allowed to masturbate. And I didn't get out of that until I was in my 20s.
Goodness me.
And the first person I started to date, I was falling for him. We just had a really great connection. But I was living in London. And I desperately didn't want to go back to Australia, not because I don't love Australia. I still call Australia home. Don't panic. But because the cult ties were so strong in Australia that I knew if I went back, I would get sucked back in. There was no way out. And I got to the point where I was like, I know I want out. And Australia, everywhere I could live, I knew people. And in London, I could safely get out and start a new life. Also, I loved London. I was new. I always wanted to live here. You know, I was so excited by it, the way you are excited by the new. Obviously, now I go back to Australia and I'm like, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake. This lifestyle here is absolutely amazing. What did I do? But my life's, you know, my tent poles are here now. Tom, what were you going to say? Interrupted you.
No, it's fine. Just immediately the kind of language you're using, we've heard from people that left relationships or a toxic partner or an abusive partner or even a regular relationship, and they've realized that, oh my God, I need to be away from this person. Otherwise, I'm just going to fall back into what I've known. I just know I am going to give them a text in a day or a week or 2 weeks and fall back into what's already safe to me. So yeah, fascinating. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in life, we just need to be physically like distance yourself from this job or this cult, as you said in your words, or this relationship. Yeah, interesting.
My ex-boyfriend is the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he was a bad boyfriend. He's my ex. a bit like, you know how if a nun marries Jesus,
yeah,
because she's the bride of Christ.
Of course.
And she has that little ceremony where she's like, she fully marries Jesus. Mm-hmm. Bit weird. bit weird to marry Jesus.
Considering all your friends are also marrying Jesus, like you're all married to the same guy.
Massive polygamist and also a sexless polygamous. You know, it's not the dream.
No.
Then you leave. Jesus kind of is your ex-boyfriend, your ex-husband. Mm. So that's kind of me. And you're right, a cult is very much like being in a toxic, narcissistic relationship where your needs are subsumed. It's just a bit more overt with a cult. It's just like, you know, you must, it's just poverty.
Rules are written down.
Obedience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poverty, chastity, and obedience, very much the same if you're a pioneer, which is what I was in the Jehovah's Witness. Pioneers knock on doors full time. Increasingly nowadays, they often stand with a cart and on the side of the road, but you've probably seen them. But in my day, it was all door knocking, and you worked 2 days a week, and you didn't get paid for that, so you were a sort of unpaid bookseller, really. So you were 2 days a week in a shop or minimum wage job to survive. So you were very poor. When I was renting a flat with other pioneers, we were all kind of, you know, out doing our thing. We often had our electricity cut off. We couldn't afford to buy groceries. I mean, it was terrible. And of the three, poverty is the worst. I can do obedience and chastity better than I can do poverty. Just that sort of grind of it all. And I had to be away. Imagine that. Imagine your ex, you're very young. Your ex is back in Australia. You know, if you go back there, he'll be right there. And he'll suck you back in and you won't be able to. And all of your friends and family go, you should be with him. He's amazing. And if you don't be with him, we won't speak to you or we'll alienate you. You just can't. And also London was new and exciting and fabulous. And lots of Australians have come out and been lured in with the excitements of London. And yes. Then years later, when their whole life is there, has gone back to Australia and gone, the weather, the lifestyle, also the theatre in Melbourne, Sydney's amazing. What am I doing? But it's too late. Your whole life's back here. And I do love London and I love spending time every year in Australia as well. So I love coming to Brisbane, actually. I'm coming to Brisbane very soon when I get there, and I'm just going to spend a couple of days getting off my jet lag and seeing my Brisbane friends. And I love it. But now the ex isn't luring me back there. Mm. So that is the landscape in which in London, I decided there was no other way of staying unless I married a gay man so I could stay in the country. Now, since that time, gay men have selfishly campaigned to be allowed to marry each other.
Yes. We wanted gay marriage. We wanted our own marriage.
Tom, it's rude because back in the day, that's what before equal marriage, which obviously I also campaigned for. I Antipathy in young women, what they did is they found a gay man who went, well, I can never get married anyway. I'm just wasting this plus one. And usually they, well, no use. They wanted something, understandably, why they're just going to marry a random. And I was told they wanted £2,000. That was the going rate. That was the going rate. It was worth more back then. This is before the Second World War, Liz.
True. Okay,
and I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Obviously.
It was during the Blitz. it was very recent because I'm terribly young. But it was the late 90s, in fact. What year were you born, Liz? Okay, so you were alive. That's fine.
Yeah, I was alive.
We're talking about an era you were alive. You were not eligible for marriage. I discovered that gay men did not want £2,000. They wanted a beard. They wanted you to kind of get married in front of their mum and then or their work colleagues or something, and then come and visit them a few times and hang around and pretend to be married. And then a year later, they could just say, oh, it didn't work out. We got divorced.
Yeah. Yep, perfect.
Because they were, it was a much more closeted time. For many people, for, you know, reasons of structural oppression. So sad, really. For various reasons, I found that quite difficult. I thought, oh, no, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. And at the same time, I started dating a man. And I said, oh, by the way, this nice bisexual man who said, I don't want anything at all. I'm fine. I don't want to get married myself and I'm just going to marry you. And I said to Tom, who I was dating, I said, oh, just to let you know, don't be alarmed because we're seeing each other, but I'm going to marry someone else. And he went, that's not the least alarming thing I've ever heard. And I said, no, it's not like that. I explained, and he said, no, I don't want you marrying somebody else. He said, I'll marry you. And I went, no, that'll ruin it. We're falling in love. And he said, no, I don't want anyone else to marry you, and I don't want to take you to the airport. And really, those are my other options. He said, so I'm going to marry you. And I was like, oh, it's going to ruin it. But actually, because our parents were so upset about it, we were so young, Tom insisted we both tell our parents. I mean, what a drama. They were so angry and freaked out. Tom's father said if he could find out where the wedding was going to happen, he'd come and stop it. So when they said, we only had a couple of friends there, like witnesses who were very uncomfortable. When they said, does anyone know of any reason why this marriage shouldn't happen? Everyone looked at the door. Like, it was terrible. Was terrible.
Deb, why did he object?
Because he went back and said, I'm marrying an Australian you've never met tomorrow.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
And he didn't tell them we were seeing each other and that we were falling in love.
Right. So we went doing straight me a favor. To marriage.
He said he thought that they would just say, you don't know what you're doing. You hardly know her. So he pretended it was a favor, which it fully wasn't. We weren't absolutely seeing each other. When they found out that, they were absolutely fine. They were like, oh, if you're in love, then, you know, they had family opposition to their marriage because they were different religions. Mm. And so they were like, no, we're totally fine with it. But it was the way he put it to them. My parents, I had to ring them and say, I'm not a Jehovah's Witness anymore and I'm marrying someone you've never met. But they were in Australia. It was too far away to come. Why so the drama.
Oh, my God. Drama, I can't stop hearing you say that now. And it's been how many years? Like, no. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. The drama. So anyway, what we said was, we'll stay married for a year. Then we can always split up and get married properly down the line if we're still together. But we just got more and more married. And when people would say, you know, when are you two going to get married? As people did then in the early noughties, rudely.
They still do. I'm single and people are like, so when are you going to settle down? And I'm like, are we still doing this? It's 2024.
Are we still doing this? Well, people used to say it then all the time. When are you two going to get married? And eventually we just started coming out to people and going, okay, look, because I'm going to tell you, we are not living in sin. We've been married for ages. We're not shacking up. We've been married for ages.
Surprise.
And we just started telling people like, what? You're already married. So eventually we had a proper wedding with all our friends and family there. White dress through the bouquet, the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful wedding. And when the first time we ever got married, when the celebrant said, I now pronounce you husband and wife, everyone just stared because there were like literally six friends and they all just went. And she said, perhaps a little round of applause. And everyone went, golf clap.
Okay.
when we got married in 2008, with all our friends and family there, and we got married in my old Oxford college. I went to University at Oxford, and I sang with the college choir at Trinity. And it's, so this, it's a literally an Elizabethan chapel, very, very beautiful. And we had, you know, the whole nine yards, not religious, but I sang with the choir and I loved that kind of choral music. We had the choir, it was beautiful. Mm. When the vicar said, I now pronounce you husband and wife, the cheering that broke out, because everyone knew us as Deborah and Tom by then. Most of our friends had never known us separately. Mm. And they also, a lot of them knew the story. They cheered so much, they could not stop cheering. Like they were like, oh, and she had to go, okay, we have to move on now. Can you stop? And Tom said the juxtaposition between the first one and the second one was so huge. The first one, people going, you're mad, you're going to break up, this is awful, what a terrible idea, what are you doing? And the second one, people like, you know, you're in for the long haul, was so lovely. So this is why I don't have any exes, because I went straight from a cult into a marriage.
And like, it seems like a good idea. I'm not going to say it seems like you've done it. Like you've done well, Deb.
It was all a terrible idea, and somehow it still worked out.
I think the best things in dating sometimes are, though, right? Like the people who you go, well, I'm not sure about them, blah, blah, blah. And the next minute you can't imagine your entire life without them.
I think a lot of people end up together for long-term and short-term relationships where they don't plan on it. I do. Me and my partner early on accosted each other. I didn't plan on falling into a relationship with you. This wasn't on my bill of things to do today, but that happened. And here we are 5 years later, we're still trucking along. I think it's okay. It's nice when it happens.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have to have everything in your life planned out, leave some room for some surprise, right?
So, Deb, what kind of things have you learnt, I guess, about the dating world from different guests on your show across the years?
That's a really good question. I think one of my favorite things was Celia Piccola, who said we asked her what theme she wanted to do. We wanted to have her on the show. The first time she ever came on, she was the guest. And we said, what do you want to talk about in feminism? She said, and this is early doors. So we were still doing anger and apologizing and how we felt about our bodies. And, you know, we were still doing this sort of really broad, big top line themes.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I want my episode to be called Crazy Cat Lady.
I just listened to that episode because it was an encore episode. I just listened to that like a couple of
times. God, so funny. I laughed so much because I was like, oh, is this a feminist? What she said. So I started researching it. And the reason that women Celia's point was she said, I want to get a cat, but I have to get a boyfriend first. So that people don't call me a cat, crazy cat lady. She's like, I don't understand. She said, I want lots of cats. She said, but if I get lots of cats, people are going to go, oh, she's lonely, she's weird. And she said, but a woman with loads of dogs, people go, oh, she sounds fun. She's probably got a jet ski. And she was like, why? Why am I allowed to have a bunch of dogs and people are going to think I'm a good time? But if I have a bunch of cats, I'm weird, lonely, and undateable. And I was like, that is such a great insight for me. But we looked into it, and cats were thought to be somehow spooky and magical, because they are a bit spooky and magical and they look like they know what you're thinking. And so women who had cats were thought to be witches. And we looked up the origin of all sorts of things for it. But the main thing was, like, a man, I don't know what a man has to do to have a whole heap of ideas projected at him. Like she was saying, if you have a goldfish, like a man has a goldfish, nobody makes any assumptions about what kind of guy that is. But a woman has a cat and there's all these jokes about she's lonely, she's, you know, undateable, she's old, she's given into a lonely life, or a, you know, the idea that a woman can't be happy single. Like one of the biggest insights I've got is that some of my friends / guests, their chosen state, their happily ever after, is being single and either having the option of lots of fun and sexual partners, or that's not what they want. In some cases, they're asexual. In some cases, they're very happy if someone comes along to have, you know, have a sexual encounter or a period, and they're open to the idea of dating if they meet someone, but it's just not their driver. It's not what gets them up in the morning. And it's the least desirable thing that could happen, because they want to be able to be very mobile, very agile, go where they want to go, not really consider anyone else. And that's their preferred state. They've been in relationships that have been happy. They've been in relationships that have been sad, but all of them have tethered them in a way that singleness has not, and has given them more options. And that what they want is options. So they're like, oh, well, it would be really inconvenient if I met somebody that I really wanted to settle down with, because, you know, I don't really want that. Maybe if I met someone, and this is what I feel about my relationship. I never wanted to settle down. I never wanted a happy ending. I wanted somebody who wanted to go on the same kind of adventure as me, but also knew that if I, the bit of my adventure wasn't a bit of their adventure, I can go off this way, they can go off this way, and we'll meet back. And that's very much how Tom and I operate. I'll be like, I'm going to go to Australia for 2 months to tour and see my family. Do you want to come for any of that? And he'll either go, no, I've got this and that going on. You go. I'll just miss you. But also, we'll talk. We'll have our exciting times. We come back, you tell me all about it. Or this time he's like, yeah, I'll just come out for a couple of weeks, see your family. I've never been to Melbourne. Let's have a bit of an adventure. Then I'll come back and you go on the tour. And I think we've always been like that. Tom will be like, you know, I'm going out to do this thing. He's just written a book called Unedited Proof Not for Resale. I've just seen it on the desk. It's not called Unedited Proof Not for Resale. It's called Star Trek Discovering the TV Series. And he watched every single episode of Star Trek, one episode a day. He'd never watched Star Trek. He's a sci-fi guy. He loves Doctor Who and stuff. But he'd never, ever, just hadn't gotten into it. And it wasn't one of his things. So he went, a person like me should love Star Trek. What if I watched an episode a day and reviewed every episode and then wrote a book about it? So we got a commission to do that. And so it's literally the experience of a sci-fi guy going in and watching every single episode of Star Trek. And it's a great book. But to do that, he had to watch an episode of Star Trek literally every single day for, I don't know, a couple of years or something. Can't remember how long it took him. I didn't watch one of those.
Right.
I didn't watch one.
Excellent choice.
So you know what I mean? Like, I sort of think that's his adventure. That's his book dedicated to me, obviously. But
you did not join him on this journey in any way, shape, or form.
No. If he wants to go where no man has boldly gone before, great. Yeah. I'll root for him. I'm so proud of him. He's on some top 10 Amazon lists at the moment for his book. And I'm like, I'm fully cheering him on. But I don't have to we just don't require or request. Neither of us ever says, but you never do this with me. I want my partner to come to a party. He doesn't like parties, like big, you know, he likes parties, but not big stand on your feet, shout at people, dance parties. He just doesn't come.
That's my ideal kind of relationship. And I think that's probably why I have chosen to be single for quite a few years now, mainly because if I do find someone, I want to find someone who I can be myself together with. And that, I think, is becoming increasingly difficult in the world. And we get a lot of guests on who talk about how difficult the dating world is because people have these checklists. They have these checklists of everything that they want in a relationship. And if someone doesn't tick one of those particular boxes, then they're automatically out of the thing. And I just think, you know, defining a relationship by checklists, boxes, it doesn't work for me. I want what you have, Deb. I want someone who I accidentally end up marrying after being in a cult and then somehow find out that I'm actually supposed to be with them and we can do our own thing together.
Yes, that's 100% it. And I love, Tom and I've got a lot in common and we love doing stuff together. And we love, you know, we love going to theater together and deconstructing it. We love binging a show together and we love eating together. I love him cooking for me and then us eating together. We love, you know, all sorts of things. It's so rare one of us will go, why don't you love this with me together as well? And I just think a healthy relationship is about time apart. And well, we opened our relationship, and I have talked about this on the podcast before, only because I felt a bit comfortable talking about it, but only because I've got a profile, I just thought if anyone sort of sensed I was with someone else and thought I was cheating on him, I'd be so upset. But I was writing a television show about Tallulah Bankhead, who's a 1920s wit and actress who lived a life. And everyone in the 20s in London, and I imagine pretty much everywhere in metropolitan places, seemed to be poly pan, just doing it all. I'm not poly, by the way. I've no interest in relationships with anybody else. I don't know how anyone does the admin whenever I've asked at shows, people always say Google calendars, but it just sounds like a nightmare
exactly
to me.
We've had feedback. Guests who practice ethical non-monogamy and their secret is always Google calendars. And I'm like,
How were people polyamorous before Google calendars? It's not clear because it's the only answer.
You're village and you can just yell your schedule across the houses. I don't know, Deborah. I wish I could answer that question.
One of my audience members said, because I used to have a bit that went, what I don't understand is, because in an open relationship, you can, you know, what goes on tour stays on tour. You can have a little experience that fulfills yourself and you learn a little bit more about yourself. Maybe it's a sort of encounter that is just about excitement, or it's about a certain sort of kink, or, you know, I wanted to explore my bisexuality or whatever. It's something you know, isn't between you in a long-term domestic relationship for whatever reason. But I was like, I very much respect, you know, anyone who's poly, but I just don't know can't get my head around quite how it works. So I had this joke in my show that was like, what do you do if one of your partners has cooked you a romantic meal and your other partner has locked themselves out of their flat and a third partner has just been arrested?
Oh.
Somebody one night, everyone would just usually laugh. And one night, somebody shouted, invite the one who's locked themselves out over to the romantic dinner, and the one who's got himself arrested can stay there. Yeah. And I was like, that is, well, clearly this has come up. This is a very specific scenario. And it was so funny, but mostly it was just Google calendars. But I just don't think I've got the kind of brain to do poly. It doesn't appeal to me at all. But we did open our relationship, and I haven't really, to be honest, done anything about it for a long time. But I had a little period. It was right. I'll tell you what, my first bisexual encounter, I had such an extraordinary experience. It's the first time I'd been with a woman. And I talked about it in this show. And it was in New Zealand. And I thought, my God, this is absolutely amazing. Clearly, this is going to be my year of sapphic self-discovery. Clearly, I was meant to do this. I did it because Tallulah Bankhead was very famously bisexual. Wasn't really a word then. So she identified as ambisextrous. And
very fun.
Yeah. She often used to say she was from America and her father was a senator. So she was from the South, very strict, you know, sort of very, you know, quote unquote moral. And she famously used to say, my father warned me about men and booze, but never said a word about women and cocaine. And so the show that I was writing, the TV show I was writing that's now morphed into a novel, is called Women and Cocaine. And I just thought, I cannot do her justice without experiencing what she's experienced. And I kind of knew I was bisexual, but I hadn't ever tried because cult to marriage, you know. Mm. And the first experience I had was so exciting. And I was like, this is going to be my year of sapphic discovery. And I took off from New Zealand and landed back in London on the 1st of March, 2020.
Oh,
no.
Yes.
I sometimes believe I caused that pandemic with lesbian hubris.
Yes, thank you for that, Deborah.
It was the sure belief that this was going to be my year of sexual discovery, and I got back and then they went, you must not leave your house.
Yes.
And we had big old lockdowns, proper serious, arrested if you leave the house more than once a day for on and off 2 years. Such a big, tight population here in, you know, London. It's just, you know, it was, you know. So, look, it's not like I've done a lot about it lately, but I will say I had never dated with apps because obviously I'd been in a relationship for a long time. And that is its own whole extraordinary world, which does at first feel very exciting and then starts to feel really unsafe. Like, well, for me anyway, everyone's got their own experience. So I can only speak for myself. But it's, and of course I've talked to people about it and talked to guests about it, talked to all sorts, but I just think, well, how many people out there have this little encounter between me and could have screenshotted it or whatever? I'm on an app called Field, which I haven't been on for a long time, but I've had a couple of people say, why are you using Deborah Frances White's photos? Because on Field, everyone has a fake name. And I'm like, everyone has a sort of stage name on Field. Mm. And most people do. And I'm like, because I'm Deborah Francis White, and they're like,
wonderful.
They're like, oh my God, I'm a big fan of your podcast. But that sometimes they'll go, basically send me a picture of you with today's newspaper so that I know it's really you. Sharon Stone got kicked off Tinder because people said she was a catfish. Mae Martin got kicked off Hinge because people said they were a catfish. I have not been kicked off Field, which I find a little insulting. But like, but sometimes women, I find in real life, I can have a real connection with them. And I always assumed I'd be a hot lesbian, but I get no action at all on apps. And I don't know why. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. But I said this one.
I think the apps, I don't think anyone's doing anything wrong. I think the apps are just awful. I think they're just really difficult and really hard for everybody.
I once had a date with a girl who, woman, God, I'm a feminist but.
I'm a feminist but, yes.
And I had talked about Field on stage. And one man, I said, I'm on Field. And one man laughed really loudly and no one else laughed. And I said, why did you laugh like that? Have you seen me on there? And he went, yeah. And I said, did you at least swipe right? And he went, no. And everyone went, oh. And I said, why not? And he said, because I listened to your podcast. I thought it would be weird. Yeah. And I was like, what do you think it's going to be like? Undermine them. And which, if you don't know my podcast, is something I say. In a sort of rote way. Every week. And I, anyway, I just said, I'm on Field. I said, my name's Tallulah. If you, you know, on Field, because I'm trying to just explore the Tallulah Bankhead experience. Mm-hmm. If you see me, say hi and say Bloomsbury, partly because, you know, Bloomsbury set stuff and partly because we were at the Bloomsbury Theatre at the time. And that night, somebody swiped right on me, beautiful woman, and said Bloomsbury. And I met her for a drink. And I said, I know women swipe right on me, but every man I swipe on swipes back. And I said, she said, that's not possible. I said, I'm going to show you. And I said, what if I'm just going to swipe on every single man? So I just swiped on every single man and every single woman and the match with men and no women. She was like, my God, this is absolutely bizarre. And then immediately these men I would never have normally swiped on started saying, hey. And I was like, oh my God. And so I started saying in front of her, it's like, I'm so sorry, sir. I seem to have wasted your time. I was just demonstrating for a friend something. And I was like apologizing to them all because I would never leave anyone on red. If I've swiped, I was like, you know. And she was laughing so much. She was going, I literally can't believe you're saying, I'm so sorry, sir. I seem to have wasted your time.
I was just making a point with someone. Have a great day.
I was
just
making a point. But they all found it funny. They were all like, oh my God, well, thank you for responding. And that's very funny. Nobody was annoyed. And I think if you do say, I'm so sorry, sir, I seem to have wasted your time, most people are very kind. But if you go, you know, if you ignore them, they get cross. So yeah, fun and games, lol times.
See, my issue with the apps,
ultimately, yeah, it feels very empty.
Yeah, look, I think my issue with the apps is that it's not good for my mental health. It's just, it got to the point where, yes, finding a partner would be nice, but all of the things that you have to navigate in terms of finding out, you know, like, I don't know. Why can't I think of anything now? Just everything. I once had someone match with me, Deb, just to tell me that the third dress that I was wearing in the third photo was not attractive to men.
See, that's no good. No good at all.
Like, that's oh the God. Whole people. And this, a friend of mine the other day was telling me a story that she got matched with just so that someone could say, you're a little bit too big for me, but you'd be cute if you lost weight. Like, this is the minefield of women seeking men at the moment, in my experience and the experience of my friends, that it just got to the point where I'm like, my self-esteem can't take this anymore. So I am going to be single.
It sucks.
Wow.
That happens. I assume it's always the tyranny of distance on social media. If you wouldn't behave like this in front of someone in real life, talking to them in a bar, I would hope and assume not.
Men do.
Yeah. Yeah.
They
no.
Do.
You'll see me.
Some men say awful things.
In preparation for you coming on this podcast, Deborah Francis White, I did put the call out to a couple of readers to send in questions. We call our listeners readers, you know, because we're delightfully old school on this podcast.
As in reader, I married him.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for getting it. We've had a couple of people write in and be like, I don't get it. We're like, it's not for you then. So If I can, I've got a couple of quick questions to ask you. The first one that was sent in is, on a first date, how would you subtly ask questions to figure out if someone is a feminist or misogynist? What's a comfort way to see whether the flags are red or green?
Well, I would say I do a podcast called The Guilty Feminist and just wait for their reaction. You could say, oh, what's your favorite podcast? They go,
Joe Rogan.
You don't need to ask anymore. But if they say, oh, it's a brilliant podcast about fishing, you can then say, oh my God, tell me about that. And then you go, I love The Guilty Feminist. It's like a really funny feminist, really, you know, really funny podcast about feminism, how we're not always very good at it, but we give it a go. And then it's kind of like, it's light and funny. You might enjoy it. And you just see by the face. And if they go, oh, no, I don't really like feminism, you know, you then go, okay, there we are. They've declared themselves. But you've not gone, are you a feminist? Prove it. You've just referenced a light. It's like a funny show. Yeah, it's really, really funny. And they have all these different guests on, you know, they do some activism, but it's really, you know, it's really, you'd really enjoy it. And if they go, oh, that sounds great. Super. What I will say is also at The Guilty Feminist, I often get a lot of third dates, and I can tell them if it's like a straight date where the man's bought the tickets and he's bought the tickets. And I sometimes do a bit about it because I can just see to kind of go, oh, look how progressive and feminist I am. And look, it's a funny show as well. We go out, we have a laugh, but look, I've bought tickets for a feminist show. I'm so safe to sleep with. I'm just the kind of guy you want to be with. I think I have got so many men laid. Look, I just feel I'm a feminist, but I worry that I've greased the wheels. And I hope they are all feminists. And this is not a pose.
Please don't listen to this podcast and now use that to trick us into bed. People
don't.
They're getting good ideas. Don't.
Smack on the hand.
But when kids I nannied for grew up and started dating, you know, they got to actually, they were at uni, they were like, oh my God, there's so many girls who are just so into The Guilty Feminist, and they tell me about it. And I go, oh, she was my nanny. And they go, what? You were nannied by The Guilty Feminist? And I was like, oh my God. And they were like, oh, the girls love it. They're like, my God, you were raised by The Guilty Feminist. Oh my God, you must be such a great guy. And I was like, I am not here to get you laid. That doesn't feel good. But anyway, they are all feminists, those boys. They're wonderful. But I've had it a few times where they've texted me and gone, I'm on a Tinder date and you've just come up and I've just said you nannied for me. And they were like, you've made that up. And I've shown them a picture on my phone and they're like, oh my God. So something subtle like that, or you reference a book you're reading. You don't always have to use my podcast. This is not me marketing my podcast. You could reference a book you're reading. You can reference a film. You can just gauge, do they know anything about it? Do they know the film? Do they know the writer? Do they know the podcast? And or are they intrigued and open? Or can you see them shutting it down? That will probably tell you. That's what I do. Otherwise, I'd just say, how do you feel about feminism? Because if they go, yeah, of course, then great. If they go, no, I think it's full of, I think it's man-hating or something, that's the date over. Why are you being subtle? Almost like you don't need to be subtle. If they're a really good guy, they'll just be like fully on board.
Yeah,
100%. About it.
I've got friends who put feminist in their biography and it immediately weeds out anybody who is going to be hurt by that.
That's a great way, because then you'd never even have to. Why are you wasting your time drinking with someone where you're having to kind of dance around it? That's a good thing. But also, again, if you don't want to be, if you know, sometimes people put their politics in their dating bio in a list, and it's some people find it a bit like it's in danger of seeming virtue signaling. Like if a man puts feminist in his bio, I'm a bit like, you know. Not that they can't, but just sort of. So again, you could put like, you know, love the following podcasts, and one of them could, you know, be a feminist podcast or books or something like that. And it will do this. It'll do the same job, but it'll come across as more fun.
Just to Deborah, just to yes and you there about men identifying as feminists. You said, oh, I probably actually wouldn't do that because maybe we get met. What advice do you have for men who genuinely try at least and come to the table and say, "Hi, I'm a humanist, therefore I'm a feminist, therefore I consider myself an ally." So, I don't know what do we?
Oh, I want men to be feminists, and some women go, "Well, you can't really be a feminist." I'm like, I want men to be feminists. I want men to identify as feminists. Absolutely. I'm just saying, if it's the first thing on your dating profile, is a list of, you know, I'm just like, sometimes it can look, it's probably a great thing to do. I'm not judging people, and I'm not saying it's I think it's virtue signaling, but sometimes I think it can come off as it's just not going to necessarily, it might make some people suspicious. It might make some people go, you know, like, that's extremely front and center, like, you want me to think you're a feminist. So, you know, women have to be very careful on dating apps. So maybe it's a more playful, fun way is to say, I love the following things, you know, like, here's some things that I enjoy. And one of them's just your favorite movie. And one of them's, I'm using it as an example again, it doesn't have to be my podcast, but one of them is the Guilty Feminist podcast. That would say to me, oh, that person's drawn in by, you know, that, but they're not going, hi, my name's Dan, I'm 6'4", feminist, Black Lives Matter, you know, this, you know, like, I'm sometimes like, you're very eager to, you know, when men in my show say that they're an ally, I say, how would we know that you were an ally if you didn't tell us?
Well, that's,
well, how would we know it? Yeah. And I ask them, like, what my big thing is, if men start talking about women in a pejorative, derogatory, or sexually objectifying, slight, you know, a slightly nasty way, I don't mean saying, oh, I really fancy her. I mean, like, you know, look at the legs on that, and it just seems a bit unpleasant. What do you do or say? Because it's actually how you act when we're not in the room that's important. And and men, interestingly, have different strategies about that for what they do. But lots of men come up with great ideas. And the biggest one, I think, is like to, I think men don't like being laughed at. So, you know, some men will go, oh, all right, Grandpa, what year do you think this is? You know, if someone's 30 and you're like, oh, have we slipped into 1978? And you make them feel old-fashioned and embarrassing, and, you know, but you don't go, excuse me, sir, like, this is not appropriate, blah, 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 which might make him just go, oh my God, you know, like, and put his, like, for me, it's always like, what strategy is going to work?
Now, Deb, when you're in a relationship, how do you manage to hold on to your feminist ideals, but at the same time, not rock the boat too much? Like, how do you balance that need for standing up for what you want in a relationship at the same time as not wanting to kind of rock the boat? Does that make sense?
I think if your boat can't be rocked, you've capsized already. Like, you need to be able to rock your own boat, don't you?
Yeah. I think the question was from somebody who was talking about they've been single for so long and they're in a relationship now, and they're finding it really difficult to not just say it's either my way or the highway, or yes, dear.
Brené Brown. Brené Brown.
Yes.
You have to watch it's her new Netflix special, and it's called Daring Greatly. And she and her husband have a practice of saying, when you don't text me, when you're late, when you don't text me, I tell myself the story that you don't care about my time. So you don't say, you never text me and you just don't care about my time. You say, when you're on your phone, when we're having dinner, I tell myself the story, our relationship doesn't have the same energy or chemistry it did once. Because you're acknowledging there's a story being told by you, and then you ask the person, is that story true? And then they will either say, you know what, I think that story might be true. Maybe we have lost some chemistry and energy and we need to work on it. Do you know what? We should have a no phone policy. Or they say, no. It's not how I'm feeling at all. That is a story, but you're telling yourself that story because the impact of me using the phone. Let me put the phone down and let's have a no phone policy. Or they say, I'm so sorry, it's just work at the moment. I just need to have the phone on. for this the rest of the week, because it's just there's such an emergency on, but it's absolutely nothing to do with you, and this that story is not correct, but you know, let from next week let's have a phone free week or whatever. I tell myself the story, and she said we do it even if we're really angry. She said sometimes we go, I tell myself the story. And she said, we force ourselves to do it, even though clearly that's not what we're meaning in that moment. But she said, it's become such a practice with us. That is the most helpful thing that you can have in a relationship, is acknowledging your feelings are a story. You've drawn a conclusion because it reminds you and it reminds them it's a story. And they, you then have to say, look, if it is a true story, you need to tell me. That story is kind of true from my side as well. And if it's not, you get to say, oh my God, nothing could be further from the truth. That's not how I'm feeling at all. It's just, you know, I'm sorry that actually was going to consider it, or it's just circumstance or whatever. So that's what I would say. Institute that as a practice, because that helps both ways, and the other person will be really happy that you've brought it in. And sit and watch Daring Greatly together, the Brené Brown Netflix special. You will not regret it.
That is such helpful information. Yes, now, fantastic. Deb, you mentioned briefly when we were off mic that you are in the process of writing a book on communication, which we are very mm-hmm. big about on this podcast.
Absolutely.
Do you have anything about that you can share with us yet?
Yes, it'll be out next April. It's called 6 Conversations We're Scared to Have. And it's about all the polarizing, well, not all, but it's about why we're more polarized now, why the left often, you know, has this, people often say that the left attacks itself. You know, someone will be trying to do something good, you know, and someone else will say, no, that's not good in the right way. That's good done badly, and so on and so on. And so I've picked some hot button culture wars, which I think are distracting us from progress that in fact the right use to divide.
Great.
Last conversation in the book chapter is called What Are We Going to Do About It? So it's got some sort of practical going forwards and analysis about, you know, these issues. So that'll be out next April, 6 Conversations We're Scared to Have. I think you can pre-order it now. But I'll come out and do a book tour in Australia, I'm sure, as well.
Fabulous. Now,
in the meantime, I'll be back in May.
Yes.
I'll be back in May. Christchurch, Auckland, Wellington. I know there's places in Aotearoa or New Zealand. Adelaide, Perth, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Canberra. And you can see who all the co-hosts are, bar Melbourne, which is just about to be announced. We've got the guests. We've got the co-hosts. She just can't be announced. And we're coming to Brisbane, because that's where you are, on the 27th of May. So get tickets now, guiltyfeminist.com/live shows. We're going to have the time of our lives. Come and rock out with us.
Cannot wait. Deb, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's very early in the morning. Well, not very early, but it's in the morning over where Deb is. We're recording late at night. So thank you very much for spending the time with us. We very much appreciate your thoughts. Everybody get along and listen to the Guilty Feminist podcast. Go buy tickets for the show. Have difficult conversations about pressing issues. Pre-order the book, yada, yada, yada. Mm. Deb, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's been wonderful having you.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight. It's been an unqualified delight. Thank you so much for having me, and hope to see you in Brisbane. Come see the show.
And in the meantime, readers, please use the Guilty Feminist podcast as a litmus test as to whether someone is worthy of your time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. But there are also unknown knowns. The ancient and esoteric order of the Jackalope is a secret society devoted to unearthing and sharing this forgotten knowledge. Each episode, we take one of these strange stories and share it with you. No topic is off limits, except for the obvious. Available wherever fine podcasts are sold.